You correct me if I'm wrong, Fred.
But my view is that the Persian Gulf is about as difficult a position geographically in which to apply U.S. countervailing power to Soviet military power in that area.
All the more enticing to them.
Therefore, all the more enticing to them. However, there is another question involved, and that is, what is the value to the USSR of dominating, let's say, Iran?
Huge.
Well, versus the damage to the West of their taking it. I think the Soviets would have to think twice about the consequences of taking an overt act which would interfere with the sovereignty of Iran. It might be that the U.S. wouldn't be in a position to react immediately to that. But I think that not only the United States, but Canada, UK, the rest of the world, would then see clearly that the real threat to the independence, not of the United States, but of everybody, comes from only one source. I think you would then have the foundations for a pulling together of all those countries and peoples equally threatened.
We might boycott the use of oil?
We'd be in real trouble. But there are things that have to do with will.
Sure.
As well as the material aspects. You mentioned that yourself just a minute ago.
I share that view, and it seems to me that for that reason, if the Arbatov Institute is doing its job properly, they will counsel the Soviet leadership to stop short of that aggressive a move, but rather concentrate on the indirect ways of undoing the free world and the underdeveloped world, as they were successful in doing by the recent tripling of oil prices, an outcome which, quite apart from all that it has done in the underdeveloped world and in the free world to hurt, has increased the net income to the Soviet Union for their oil by $1 billion.
So that any advantage that they might take of our progressive military inferiority would always be with constant reference to getting the most out of any piecemeal advance. Now, are you gloomy about our preparation for this kind of long-term warfare under our present leadership?
I happen to be very gloomy.
Why?
I don't believe that President is in a position today to give the type of leadership to the country that it requires.
You mean a kind of Watergate?
I do indeed, of the things that led up to Watergate.
Well, however, practically all of the trends that we've discussed were detectable before the Scotch tape was left on the door of Watergate, right? And at that point, Mr. Nixon was not suffering from his present embarrassments, and yet we were headed in that direction. So is it because Mr. Nixon is himself an inadequate leader, or is it because he's got a Congress he can't face, or is it because the American people are failing to give the kind of sustenance required for an effective kind of policy?
Frankly, I didn't think that things were going as badly then as they have been going in the last year. I believe there has been a material change in the evolution of things during the period since Watergate.
But if you put it on your graph, you would show a pretty direct line going down from 1967 on, wouldn't you?
That's correct, insofar as the maritime capability
is concerned. Is it accelerated by Watergate or not? If anything, it's blipping up a little, isn't it?
I think that I would agree with Paul Nitzer that there was no reason not to be optimistic about the trend of events. As we saw during the first 4 years of the Nixon administration, those developments that were likely to have improved our domestic tranquility by the withdrawal from the war effort on terms generally favorable to the United States, and as we retrenched our defense budgets to a level with which we could live over the long haul. Now, what one would suppose would have happened in the second administration, absent Watergate, was that we would have seen a gathering around and a consensus that we had, at the very least, to spend somewhat more in the conventional field than the other superpower, which has half of our gross national product.
But aren't we, in fact, spending a little more?
No, we're not. I think
the
intelligence community's calculation is that if we calculate what it costs the Russians in our economy to build what they're building, they're spending more than we are.
Mm-hmm.
this nation with just half of our gross national product. Therefore, by anybody's analysis, it's inevitable that they will overtake us if they haven't already. And my studies convince me that in the maritime area, they have already a greater probability that they can carry out their mission than we have that we can carry out ours.
And you do not relate this to Watergate except thus speculatively. You feel that if Mr. Nixon were not so preoccupied with Watergate, it may very well be that he would be directing public attention to this march of events, even to his role in them.
And more than that.
Because, as you say, the graph began pre-Watergate.
I feel we've seen a great lessening in the amount of attention that anyone in the White House gives to defense issues, foreign policy issues, any issue, except survival.
Do you think it has to do, in part, with a general feeling in America that that which we are called upon to save is not all that valuable? To it ourselves? I
was referring not just to the questions of defense production and the budget, defense budgets in the United States. I was talking about the point that I made earlier, that the political health of the United States seems to me have deteriorated during the last year as a result of Watergate. I think there's less confidence by the youth, by the public, in the institutions of government than there was a year ago. I think this is a bad thing. I think this, you know, foreign policy really is a reflection of domestic policy.
But might
arms
be useful.
Control policy and defense policy are a reflection of your foreign policy.
But isn't exactly what we want a lack of confidence in the institutions of government? It seems to me that if both of you are correct, Admiral Zumwalt in particular, we ought to have very little confidence in the institutions of government to which we give $75 or $80 billion a year,
no,
all of a sudden find ourselves approaching nightmare.
Now, I think it's essential that we have a government that merits confidence. I think it's always necessary to be skeptical of government.
Yeah.
But that's a different thing than having a government which merits confidence. I think the United States has often had, during most of its life, had governments which merited confidence.
Well, then you're saying the American people had in fact lost confidence, not in Nixon, but in the presidency.
No, in Nixon as president.
But all the graphs show that, in fact, there is a decline in American confidence in institutions.
I think this has flowed in part from its...
From the mess.
From the mess, that's right. And I think in part it's flowed from the fact that the Congress has been slow to act. Now, I'm quite sympathetic with the fact that the Congress should lean over backwards to see to it that it is not subject to the attack of having moved too fast. But still, this has been a long period where I believe the public has not had the impression that the Congress is prepared to bite the bullet in any expeditious way.
Do you agree with that, Admiral Zumwalt?
I do.
Well, is there an obvious prescription short of leadership?
I think the prescription is to get on with the constitutional processes.
I was afraid you'd say that. We're all in favor of constitutional processes. Meanwhile, isn't it your guess that not one out of 100 Americans are apprehensive about your major apprehension as described here today? And now, whatever you say about Watergate, we've still got the Reader's Digest. And why doesn't the Reader's Digest spread the news? In fact, it has, hasn't it? But nobody seems to pay any attention to it. And one of the reasons they pay no attention to it is because they feel, as long as Mr. Nixon's president, one thing we're not going to lose out to is the communists, point number one. And point number two, that in any event, Mr. Nixon's treatment of communist leaders in the last couple of years suggests that we're dealing with a race of men, all of whom have voluntarily submitted to a prefrontal lobotomy, and that all of this stuff that you quote from Brezhnev and so on is mere cant. It's just the hangover talk from people who feel that their whole theological house would break down if they stopped repeating Marxist slogans in which they no longer believe. Is that more like the American boom?
Well, I think you probably would be as apt a judge of the American mood as I. I think that the concern that I feel, having just come from the inside, is the extent to which the legitimate processes of government have come to a standstill as a result of the overwhelming concern about Watergate within the government, at the top. And I feel very worried about the fact that not only is policy not really dealt with unless it's Watergate-related, but any elements of policy which do get attention
are affected
by Watergate considerations. And it's therefore very important for this country to get it all behind us.
Well, would you say that that's true even, for instance, of Mr. Kissinger's handling of the Middle East? Do you think that was Watergate affected?
I think that very clearly there was a major element of Watergate involved in taking the position that this action on the part of the Soviet Union did not affect détente. I think it demonstrated quite clearly that the Soviet view of détente is different than our own. Their concept of détente is what I would call a differentiated détente. Behave where it's dangerous not to behave and misbehave where you think you can get away with it to the advantage of your policy. And I think that in contrast to the conventional wisdom around town, that considerable progress towards Soviet objectives was made as a result of the Mideast crisis, as I mentioned earlier.
Mr. Robert Kuttner of the Washington Post. Mr. Kuttner.
Mr. Nitze, you explained your resignation essentially in terms of a fear that because of Mr. Nixon's weakness, things really couldn't productively go much further. Was it also a fear that because of Mr. Nixon's weakness, he might be tempted to cut a more generous deal with the Russians to protect himself at home than he otherwise would have, or than you would regard as prudent?
I thought there was such a possibility, but I thought he probably would not.
Given your view that the Soviets have not really ceased to be a revolutionary power, and I gather your view is also that what made détente possible was a temporary juxtaposition of interests in strategic accommodation and economic accommodation and political stabilization. Couldn't it be said that détente had just about gone about as far as it could go anyway, apart from Nixon's weakness?
The word détente has so many meanings. It's hard to be precise about it. My own view would be that under all but the most horrible circumstances, we should maintain contact with the Soviet Union, should be negotiating with the Soviet Union, should be talking with the Soviet Union. That's quite a different thing than the impression that I think that has been given to the American public about détente. I think the American public has had the view that somehow or other this has indicated a more basic change in Soviet strategy and tactics than I see. And I think that's what Admiral Zumwalt was referring to, that it's very hard when you look at individual situations to see where the Soviet Union has made really major, has taken a course substantially different than what it might have taken if it were looking primarily to the maximization of its improvement of its own situation. I don't see these actions they've taken of making substantive contributions toward a less dangerous world.
Well, they may have held back that. North Vietnam, is that confusing? Slow them up a little.
I think they probably were helpful in the negotiations which Dr. Kissinger succeeded in bringing to a conclusion on allowing us to get our forces out of North Vietnam. I think, however, they have continued to help strengthen the eventual military position of the North Vietnamese so that the North Vietnamese, at a time that they might consider to be the right time, could make survival very difficult for the South Vietnam.
Mr. John Marks is the co-author of the best-selling book The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence.
Admiral Zumwalt, Secretary Kissinger, right after the recent talks in Moscow, made a statement that the military of both sides, Soviet and America, would have to be restrained if there were to be any progress in the strategic arms field. Now, Secretary of Defense Schlesinger said that there was no problem with our military, but Secretary Kissinger didn't issue any retractions. Isn't that the case that our military has a vested interest in bigger and more expensive weapon systems?
No, I don't concede that at all. For example, in my own case, as a director of arms control back in 1962 for the Pentagon, I worked very vigorously for the test ban treaty, and I have continued to support subsequent arms control arrangements, such as the Non-Proliferation Pact and the Hotline and SALT I. I think the military has a proper concern about the security of this country, and I think the military has a professional competence to advise civilian authority about the relative merits of individual arms control proposals. And if the public berating of the attitude of the military was done to deny the military their statutory right, indeed requirement, to give military advice, then I would worry a great deal about what the country is coming to, and would suggest that Paul Nitzer might be more competent to comment, since he's been at a position of policy in the civilian side of the hierarchy, to comment on the proper role of the military-civilian interface.
I might just comment. I think, Mr. Marks, was your quotation from Dr. Kissinger quite correct? My recollection was that what he said was that the military establishments of both sides need to be convinced of the value of restraint, rather than saying that the military establishments have to be restrained, because it is wholly, I think, unarguable that the military establishment in the United States is clearly under the direction of the president and within the control set by the Congress. I know of no Secretary of Defense, I know of no JCS body which has not responded to a valid order of the president. This is our tradition, and it's a deep tradition. It is certainly possible for the president to make a decision and have it executed by the Secretary of Defense and the JCS, even if they don't agree with it. What I think Admiral Zumwalt was referring to is that by statute, the JCS are the military advisors not only to the Secretary of Defense and to the President, but also to the Congress. And I'm sure that the intent of that statute was that the military be in a position to give their best and honest advice to the Secretary of Defense, the President, and the Congress. Now, the impression that I get now is that it is being implied, at least, by Dr. Kissinger, that the military should not give their best and honest advice, but they should mold their opinions to his views, and this I disapprove of.
Did he actually say anything like that?
I said implied. I think it was implied in the quotation that I gave.
Well, my impression of
why is it necessary otherwise to convince? You've got the right to overrule, and they've frequently been overruled.
Well, I think my impression of that is that Mr. Kissinger feels that he's doing the best he can with foreign policy, but I would be extremely surprised if he ever suggested that he wants to be other than informed by the military, concerning which he's of course technically ignorant. It may very well be that by that offhand remark in which he talked about their military and our military, he gave the wrong impression. He told me today that he was sorry he had made that remark, which suggests that he didn't anticipate the way it would be.
I think that's a perfectly valid point. I accept that. I'm sorry I took it at face value, but I'm sure you're right that he regretted it afterwards.
Mr. Herbert, stop. As an officer of Young Americans for Freedom and a graduate student at St. John's University in New York. Stop.
His book, The World Restored, and in three articles published in 1969, Henry Kissinger made two arguments that I think Admiral Zumwalt and Mr. Nitzer would agree were very realistic. The first was that a status quo nation in a revolutionary era is at a powerful disadvantage, and that is that if they don't win, they lose. The second is that any nation committed to peace as an end in itself is at the mercy of any other nation willing to risk war. I'd like to know both of your views as to, since we're at best pursuing a status quo policy, and since allegedly we're pursuing a policy of peace as an end in itself, if without a dramatic reversal in that policy, the United States will be able to survive in the future.
We have 2 minutes exactly.
Well, on the last part of your question with respect to a country that pursues peace as an absolute end, there I would agree entirely with what Henry Kissinger said in his book, and I'm sure he would today. He would not say that peace is an absolute end. He would say, certainly, one has to, if one wants to survive as a nation with some degree of sovereignty, one has to face up to the fact that you can imagine circumstances where a nation would fight in its own defense. With respect to the other part of your question, with respect to a status quo nation and its disadvantages, it has not been my impression that the United States really has been a status quo nation. Granted, we have been a status quo nation territorially, which we have no territorial ambitions, but I think we have made a most positive contribution towards a world structure, at least in the non-communist part of the world, during the period from 1946 up until the present.
My answer is that I agree with Paul Nitzan.
On both of those points.
Right.
You have no territorial ambitions.
Right.
I don't know. I kind of like to take over Albania. Well, of course, isn't it true that there is no such thing as a status quo nation, almost by definition? There is such thing as a nation that seeks to freeze history, but there had never been, so far as I know, a nation that has succeeded in doing so, has there?
I don't think so.
Certainly not among the superpowers.
I think our mission has been to try to maintain the right of people to free determination, as opposed to the Soviet mission, which is to pervert that right into what they call a socialist order.
Thank you, Admiral Zumwalt. Thank you very much, Ms. Nitzan.
Thank you, Mr.
Panel. Thank you all.